Makersoft Story Classic, bringing to you recordings of old storybooks. Sir Gibby, Episode 59, Catastrophe. Gibby went home as if Pearl Street had been the stairs of Glashgar, and the old house a mansion in the heavens. He seemed to float along the way as one floats in a happy dream, where motion is born at once of the wheel without the intermediating mechanics of nerve, muscle, and fulcrum. Love had been gathering and ever storing itself in his heart so many years for this. The man who loves most will love best. The man who thoroughly loves God and his neighbor can love her with the love God thought of between them when he made man, male, and female. The man, I repeat, who loves God with his very life and his neighbor as Christ loves him is the man who is capable of grand, perfect, glorious love to any woman. Because Gibby's love was towards everything human, he was able to love Ginevra as Donal, poet and prophet, was not yet grown able to love her. To that of the most passionate of unbelieving lovers, Gibby's love was as the fire of a sun to that of a forest. The fullness of a world of love ways and love thoughts was Gibby's. It was this essential love, acknowledging and embracing as a necessity of its being everything that could be loved, which now concentrated its rays on the individual's individual. His love to Ginevra stood like a growing thicket of aromatic shrubs until her confession set the fire of heaven to it, and the flame that consumes not but gives life arose and shot homeward. He had never imagined, never hoped, never desired she should love him like that. She had refused his friend, the strong, the noble, the beautiful Donal, the poet, and it never could, but from her own lips had found way to his belief that she had turned her regard upon wee Sir Gibby. His devotion to her had forestalled every pain with its antidote of perfect love, had negated every lack, had precluded every desire, had shut all avenues of entrance against self. Even if a little thought and sound should have chanced upon an entrance, it would have found no soil to root and grow in. The soil for the harvest of pain is that brought down from the peaks of pride by the torrents of desire. Immeasurably the greater thereof was his delight, when the warmth and odor of the love that had been from time to him immemorial, passing out from him in virtue of consolation and healing, came back upon him in the softest and sweetest of flowering, waking spring winds. Then, indeed, was his heart a bliss. He entered the close of the Audi house, but the excess of his joy had not yet turned to light, was not yet passing from him in physical flame, whence then the glow that illuminated the court. He looked up. The windows of Mistress Crowell's bedroom were glaring with light. He opened the door, hurried, and darted up. On the stair he was met by the smell of burning, which grew stronger as he ascended. He opened Mistress Crowell's door. The chintz curtains of her bed were flaming to the ceiling. He darted to it. Mistress Crowell was not in it. He jumped upon it and tore down the curtains and tossed her, trampling them under his feet upon the blankets. He had almost finished, and at the bottom of the bed was reaching up and pulling at the last of the flaming rags, when a groan came to his ears. He looked down. There, at the foot of the bed, on her back upon the floor, lay Mistress Crowell, in her satin gown, with red, swollen face, wide open mouth, and half open eyes, dead drunk, a heap of ruin. A bit of glowing tinder fell on her forehead. She opened her eyes, looked up, uttered a terrified cry, closed them, and was again motionless, except for her breathing. On one side of her lay a bottle, on the other a chamber candlestick upset, with the candle guttered into a mass. With the help of the water jugs and the bath which stood ready in his room, he succeeded at last in putting out the fire, and then turned his attention to Mistress Crowell. Her breathing had grown so stertorous that he was alarmed, and getting more water, bathed her head and laid a wet handkerchief on it, after which he sat down and watched her. It would have made a strange picture, the middle of the night, the fire-blasted bed, the painful, ugly carcass on the floor, and the sad, watching ear. The slow night passed. The gray of the morning came, chill and cheerless. Mistress Crowell stirred, moved, crept up rather than rose to a sitting position, and stretched herself, yawning. Gibbie had risen and stood over her. She caught sight of him. Absolute terror distorted her sodden face. She stared at him, then stared about her, like one who had suddenly waked in hell. He took her by the arm. She obeyed, rose, and stood, fear conquering the remnants of drunkenness, with her whiskey-scorched eyes following his every movement. As he got her cloak and bonnet, he put them on her. She submitted like a child, caught in wickedness and cowed by the capture. He led her from the house out into the dark morning, made her take his arm, and away they walked together, down to the riverside. She gave a reel now and then, and sometimes her knees would double under her, but Gibbie was no novice at the task, and brought her safe to the door of her lodging, of which, in view of such a possibility, he had been paying the rent all the time. He opened the door with her pass key, led her up the stair, unlocked the door of her garret, placed her in a chair, and left her, closing the doors gently behind him. Instinctively, she sought her bed, fell upon it, and slept again. When she woke, her dim mind was haunted by a terrible vision of resurrection and damnation, of which the only point she could plainly recall was an angel, as like Sir Gibbie as he could look, hanging in the air above her, and sending out flames on all sides of him, which burned her up, inside and out, shriveling soul and body together. As she lay thinking over it, with her eyes closed, suddenly she remembered, with a pang of dismay, that she had got drunk and broken her vow. That was the origin of the bad dream, and the dreadful headache, and the burning at her heart. She must have water. Painfully lifting herself upon one elbow, she opened her eyes. Then what a bewilderment! And what a discovery, slow unfolding itself, were hers. Like her first parents, she had fallen. Her paradise was gone. She lay outside among the thorns and thistles before the gate. From being the virtual mistress of a great house, she was back in her dreary, lonely garret, re-exiled in shame from her briefly regained respectability, from friendship and honorable life, and the holding forth of help to the world. She lay there, a sow that had been washed, and washed in vain. What a sight of disgrace was her grand satin gown, wet and scorched, and smeared with candle, and ugh, how it smelled of smoke, and burning, and the dregs of whiskey. And her lace? She gazed at her finery as an angel might on his feathers, which the enemy had burned while he slept on his watch. She must have water. She got out of bed with difficulty, then for a whole hour sat on the edge of it motionless, unsure that she was not in hell. At last she wept acrid tears from very misery. She rose, took off her satin and lace, put on a cotton gown, and was once more decent-looking. Poor body, except as to her glowing face and burning eyes, which to bathe she had nothing but tears. Again she sat down, and for a space did nothing, only suffered in ignominy. At last life began to revive a little. She rose and moved about the room, staring at the things in it. There on the table lay her keys, and what was that under them? A letter addressed to her. She opened it and found 5-pound notes, with these words, "I promise to pay to Mrs. Crowell 5 pounds monthly for 9 months to come, Gilbert Galbraith." She wept again. He would never speak to her more. She had lost him at last, her only friend. Lost him forever, she thought. The day went on, cold and foggy without, colder and drearier within. Sick and faint and disgusted, the poor heart had no atmosphere to beat in save an infinite sense of failure and lost opportunity. She had fuel enough in the room to make a little fire, and at length had summoned resolve sufficient for the fetching of water from the street pump. She went to the cupboard to get a jug. She could not carry a pailful. There in the corner stood the whiskey, her own old familiar, the black bottle, as if it had been patiently waiting for her all the long dreary time she had been away. With a flash of fierce joy she remembered she had left it half full. She caught it up and held it between her and the fading light of the misty window. It was half full still. One glass, a hair of the dog, would set her free from faintness and sickness, disgust and misery. There was no one to find fault with her now. She could do as she liked. There was no one to care, nothing to take fair. She set the bottle on the table because her hand shook and went again to the cupboard to get a glass. On the way, borne upward on some heavenly current from the deeps of her soul, the face of Gibby, sorrowful because loving, met her. She turned, seized the bottle, and would have dashed it on the hearthstone, but that a sudden resolve arrested her lifted arm. Gibby should see. She would be strong. That bottle should stand on that shelf until the hour when she could show it him and say, "See the proof of my victory." She drove the cork fiercely in. When its top was level with the neck, she set the bottle back in its place, and from that hour it stood there, a temptation, a ceaseless warning, the monument of a broken but repairable vow, a pledge of hope. It may not have been a prudent measure. To a weak nature it would have involved certain ruin, but there are natures that do better under difficulty. There are many such. And with that fiend-like shape in her cupboard, the one ambition of Mistress Croale's life was henceforth inextricably bound up. She would turn that bottle into a witness for her against the judgment she had deserved. Close by the cupboard door, like a kite or an owl, nailed up against a barn, she hung her soiled and dishonored satin gown, and the dust, having now gathered, took the jug and fetched herself water. Then, having set her kettle on the fire, she went out with her basket and bought bread and butter. After a good cup of tea and some nice toast, she went to bed again, much easier both in mind and body, and slept. In the morning, she went to the market, opened her shop, and waited for customers. Pleasure and surprise at her reappearance brought the old ones quickly back. She was friendly and helpful to them as before, but the slightest approach to inquiry as to where she had been or what she had been doing, she met with simple, obstinate silence. Gibby's bounty and her faithful abstinence enabled her to add to her stock and extend her trade. By and by she had the command of a little money, and when in the late autumn there came a time of scarcity and disease, she went about among the poor like a disciple of Sir Gibby. Some said that from her knowledge of their ways, from her judgment, and by her personal ministration of Wat, for her means she gave more bountifully than any. She did more to hearten their endurance than all the ladies together who administered money subscribed. It came to Sir Gibby's ears and rejoiced his heart. His old friend was on the king's highway still. In the meantime, she saw nothing of him. Not once did he pass her shop, where often her mental, and not unfrequently her bodily, attitude was that of a watching lover. The second day, indeed, she saw him at a little distance, and sorely her heart smote her, for one of his hands was in a sling, but he crossed to the other side, plainly to avoid her. She was none the less sure, however, then, when she asked him, he would forgive her, and ask him she would as soon as she had satisfactory proof of repentance to show him. Thank you for listening to another episode of Acresoft Story Classic.